Well, good evening. Good to see everybody tonight. Do you have a Bible this evening? We're going to the mountain message, 7th division of Matthew's gospel is where we will begin in just a moment or two. Matthew chapter 7. While you're opening your Bible and getting settled, we welcome all of you. Thank you so much for being here on this Wednesday night. As we have said on occasion this week, if you're visiting with this church family, as I am for these few days, we especially welcome you. Thank you for coming our way. Thank you for being here and for the encouragement that you give us by your presence. If you're visiting tonight, we hope you'll be able to come and be with this good church family again. Hope you can do that soon and hope you can do that often. This is a wonderful congregation of God's people and you would enjoy, I know, visiting with them and coming to know the folks who compose this good church. Wonderful to be with you tonight. I've enjoyed immensely being with you. We have, as we said on Friday night as we began, we've been together a good bit over the past couple of years, and I've enjoyed that immensely, and this has been certainly no exception to that. You all are so very gracious, very warm, very hospitable. You make me feel very welcome among you, and for that, I am very, very grateful. Thank you. Thank you to your shepherds for the invitation to come and to share these several days. I've enjoyed this immensely because these few days have been different than typically what we would do in a gospel meeting. We've been able to preach this week, but also taught some Bible classes this week, special classes, and we have also visited with your leadership, your shepherds and deacons, and all of that. It's just been extremely pleasant. I've enjoyed that very, very much. Appreciate Parker leading our singing tonight and all the men who've helped us sing this week. That's been very, very good and very pleasant. I appreciate good singing, and you all clearly enjoy singing a great bit. I like to sing. I don't have a lot of ability. People don't appreciate my singing ability, I usually say, because I have none whatsoever. And at Temple Terrace, where I've been for these three decades, I've asked to lead singing, I bet, 100 times. And every time, the answer has always been the same, no. And I do believe, if I understand correctly, they are just about to let me sing a solo of the Old Rugged Cross. I believe that's right, because I heard one of the elders say, we're only going to let Don sing on a hill far away. And now maybe that meant something else and I just didn't get it, but I appreciate those who help us worship in song, and I know that means an awful lot to you in this congregation. Appreciate very much those of you who have had me in your home, or we've gone somewhere and we've had a cup of coffee, or we have eaten a meal together and got to visit. Thank you for that very, very much. And of course, I have loved this week getting to be with your preachers, with Jeff and David and Randy and Hunter, these men who do so much so well for this church family. My colleagues in preaching are always very special to me, and so I have enjoyed that immensely also. And I've liked the fact that we've been able to talk this week about matters of our home, about having hopefully a home that is in the image of what God designed and hoped for it to be. Tonight, we want to talk a little bit about remembering and honoring our vows, and that is how to the best of our ability, we can have a marathon marriage. You know, in 60 days, the calendar is going to turn to June. And June, of course, is the month of weddings. There are more weddings that take place in the United States in June than in any other month of the year. Now, there are all kinds of weddings. There are royal weddings and shotgun weddings. There are formal weddings, informal weddings. There are double weddings and destination weddings. There are weddings at the courthouse and weddings at the church house. There are weddings that are very, very carefully orchestrated, and there are weddings that are organized chaos. There are all different kinds of weddings. The average book about marriage contains 90,000 words. The average sermon about marriage contains 5,000 words, and the average wedding ceremony contains 1,000 words. It's estimated that in America in 2023, some 2 million of those wedding ceremonies will take place, which means that 4 million people in America will stand before family and friends and God, and they will promise to each other they're going to keep the vows that they make to each other until by death they part. And I believe with all of my heart that most everybody who makes those vows, they intend to keep those promises that they make. And yet, you know that before about 15 years will pass, somewhere between 40 and 50% of those who exchange those vows will have violated them in some way. How does that happen? Because we understand that that is not merely an academic issue. We understand that it's hard even to find a family among the people of God that has not been touched by divorce. That my family has certainly been, and I would imagine that most in this audience, if you probably don't have to go back very far in your families to find where that has been introduced into the equation. How does that happen? How does that happen, especially among the people of God? Well, maybe it's because oftentimes we don't start right. You know, troubles come in our marriage when we start wrong. It is very difficult to start wrong and end up where you want to be. And so when we marry just for ourselves or for what's in it for us and not how we can serve our mate, that's a very bad way to start. And beyond that, when we marry without any preparation, I have seen the statistics several times that the average couple in preparation for their wedding day will spend about 200 hours and yet less than 8 hours in preparation for their marriage. There's something wrong with that, something truly askew in that. And then, of course, if we live wrong, sin will destroy any marriage. And so when we fail to keep our vows, our promises, our pledges that we make in marriage, when we allow unfaithfulness to begin to fill our heart, inevitably then difficulties are going to come. And then sometimes it's just that we think wrong. When we become stubborn in our own way and refuse to change and evolve in the relationship. Dr. John Gutman said in his work, Seven Principles for Making Marriage Work, he speaks of the four horsemen of the apocalypse in marriage. And he called them criticism, which leads to complaining, which leads to defensiveness, which leads to stonewalling. That is a separation emotionally and physically between the parties involved. All of those things, of course, are absolutely deadly, detrimental to our marriages. We need to think very soberly about that because marriage is a covenant-based relationship. I'm talking to an audience that understands that. We talk about that a lot in our churches, don't we? That when we make those vows and exchange those commitments to each other, particularly as Christians, that should have particular importance to us because we know that Christians are called upon by God to be particularly faithful in what we promise. The verses along that line are everywhere in our Bibles. Numbers 30 and verse 2, if a man makes a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to bind himself by some agreement, he should not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. And so as far back as Moses talking to his children, the children of Israel, he emphasizes that the promises and vows that we make are to be scrupulously kept. A familiar passage in Ecclesiastes 5. When you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it. He has no pleasure in fools. And so pay what you have vowed. Better not to vow than to vow and not pay. Do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin. In other words, do not write a check with your mouth that you will not cash in the commitment of life. And so God is insistent about that. Interesting passage in Psalm 15 where the psalmist said, Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle and who may dwell in your holy hill? In other words, God, with whom will you have fellowship? With whom will you have fellowship? And while there are a multiplicity of answers that are given in the 15th Psalm, notice this one, the one who swears to his own hurt and does not change. The one who makes a vow and commitment, if in our case tonight, in marriage and determines that regardless, come what may, he is going to keep the commitment that he has made both to God and to his mate. And then finally, think about this from Malachi 2 and 14. The Lord, Yahweh, has been a witness between you and the wife of your youth. In other words, God heard our vows, witnessed the commitment that we made, and holds us accountable. God takes those vows seriously. And we should as well. I think what all of us want are marathon marriages. We want marriages that begin well. Oftentimes the beginning part is very easy, but then we want marriages that are going to be able to survive the difficulties that arise during the middle years, and we want marriages that will continue to thrive even in the later years for the longevity that we all want in our marriage. I don't think anybody in this room wants to be like the elderly married couple. They were 90 years old. They went to a lawyer and they said, we want a divorce. And he looked at them and he said, a divorce? How old are you? They said, we're both 90 years old. How long have you been married? 70 years. Why would you want to get a divorce now? And the man said, well, we were just waiting for the kids to die. Well, I don't think we want that. We want those marriages to end as long, happily as they possibly can. But marathon marriages don't happen by accident. They happen by work. By working on the communication, working on the financial issues, working on the intimate relationship. And so at the very beginning tonight, we need to debunk the myth that marathon marriages just don't have any problems, that really you've got two individuals who are so amazingly compatible that no difficulties arise. That simply is not true. There is no such thing as this one perfect person who finds this other perfect person, and together they form a perfect marriage. It just doesn't work that way. Life is not a Hallmark movie. Every marriage, as we said the other night, involves two imperfect people living in an imperfect world. When difficulties come, it is easier to buy the grass is always greener on the other side of the marital fence. But I would say to you tonight that if the grass is greener on the other side of the marital fence, it's because the individuals there are watering that grass. They're working on that relationship. I want tonight, with your permission, to talk about two aspects of a marathon marriage. On one side of the equation, I want us to talk for just a moment about some of the challenges that come to a long-term marriage. And then secondly, we want to talk tonight about the promises and vows, the commitments that we made when we marry, and remind ourselves a little bit of them. There are multiple things in our culture in 2023 that work, that coalesce to undermine the foundation of our marriages. Do you have your Bible tonight? I want you to read with me at the end of the mountain message in Matthew 7. At the end of Matthew 7, for all intents and purposes, Jesus has concluded the sermon, and now, to use our vernacular, we would say that really he's extending the invitation. He doesn't say, let's all stand and sing now, but what he is doing is calling upon individuals to make a decision, a commitment in their lives. And he concludes really by saying this in verse 24, Therefore, his conclusionary statement is this: whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain descended, the floods came, the winds blew and beat on that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. Let's stop there for just a moment. I want us to think about that idea that Jesus introduces here of rain and wind and flood. Because I will tell you, there are things in our culture in 2023 that can all be defined under those headings that mitigate against long-term marriages. For example, the reign of culture. The reign of culture. You understand, living in Southeast Texas, something about rain, don't you? You understand that rain can soak and permeate everything, just as culture permeates our lives. And just as rain can erode a foundation of a home in Southeast Texas, the fact is that culture can erode a marriage. Building a marathon marriage has never been easy, but has there ever been a culture that has made it more difficult? I don't really know the answer to that. But I will tell you, the culture in which we live today certainly has multiple elements that coalesce to make it difficult. George Gallup of the polling research data, George Gallup said that there are four factors in American culture that are undermining the stability of marriage. Those four factors he identified, number one, as alternative lifestyles. And certainly that's true, isn't it? I mean, never before have we seen such propaganda and pressure to accept all kinds of alternative, aberrant lifestyles as though they are the normal. And so we have in America, we hear every day on the news, the alphabet of acceptance, LGBT and Q. And somehow we are being told that this is normal and that should be accepted. In 2020, for example, we were treated to the spectacle of a gentleman who announced his candidacy for President of the United States, and he received tremendous media coverage as he introduced himself and his husband on the stage. The idea of one man and one woman together is decried as being so very narrow and backward thinking. And yet Jesus four times said, a man shall leave his father and mother and shall be joined to his wife. And Gallup said, secondly, sexual immorality. Scandal has been taken out of immorality in American culture, as you're well aware. It's almost expected now that somehow, some way, at some point in time, immorality is going to be introduced in the equation of a long-term marriage, because after all, who could expect somebody to be monogamous for all of those years? I was at our in In Texas, I know you have HEB. In Florida, our major grocery store is Publix. And I was in our Publix in Temple Terrace a while back, and I was about to check out, and the magazines were all up there. And there was a big, bold headline on one of the magazines that said, 10 reasons to commit adultery. 10 reasons to commit adultery. Well, I wanted to see what they said, so I opened the magazine, and it was the kind of things that you would expect. Adultery will make you a more well-rounded individual. But number 10 was this. Adultery is fun. Adultery is fun. And that was just about the time that I had been called to one of our members' home on a Monday morning. And when I arrived, the lady in that house was curled up in a fetal position on her couch. And she was sobbing inconsolably. I was not able to calm her down for the longest of time. But when finally she was able to collect herself, she acknowledged that she had been involved in a long-term sexual relationship with a man other than her husband. And she was a broken soul. She was a broken human being. And I thought about that when I saw that 10th item, that adultery is fun. And I thought, you know what? I could have thought of an awful lot of adjectives to describe that woman that day, but fun would not have been one of them. Sexual immorality is destroying the longevity of our marriages. And Gallup said, third, material greed, materialism. Addiction to materialism is destroying marriages. Did you see on the news last week? Last week on the news, it was said that the average person in a marriage in America has $16,000 of credit card debt. So for a husband and wife, that would be $32,000 of credit card debt. I think that debt really is the unspoken secret of so many of our families, and so many families are just being crushed under that. And then fourth and finally is radical feminism, he said. We're not talking here about equal pay for equal work. What we're talking about is the concept that has come to hold sway in America that somehow a woman's worth is diminished if she finds fulfillment in her home and in her children. And the point very simply is that multiple cultural factors are working together to undermine our families. And the question is, well, what do we do about that? Well, I'll tell you what we need to understand about that. We need to understand, as Moses said, look, you shall not follow the crowd to do evil. You shall not follow the crowd to do what is evil. We need to listen to Paul when he said, do not be conformed to this world, but you be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good, acceptable, and perfect will of God. And we need to do that, of course, about our marriages, the reign of culture. And then secondly, I think the winds of change. Because the winds of change blow into every marriage, because no marriage is static. We change in marriage over time. How many times have you heard somebody say, well, you know what, we just kind of grew apart. He or she, they're just not the same person that I married. Well, of course not, because we change. How many times have you heard somebody say, you know, it's just not like it used to be in our marriage? But again, of course not, because anything that is alive must go through change. In a marathon marriage, as we are going to, we're going to have to survive multiple changes. We certainly change physically. I mean, over the course of time, we change physically. I think the favorite little story I ever heard about that was about a wife who walked into her den one day, and her husband was stretched out on the couch, and he was taking a nap. And the wife went over and she looked down at her husband, and she was kind of overcome with emotion about how much she loved him. And so she sat down on the edge of the couch, and he kind of woke up a little bit. And she reached down and she took his glasses off. And she looked at him and she said, you know, without your glasses, you are still a very, very handsome man. And he looked at her and he said, you know, without my glasses, you are still a very beautiful woman. He too was never heard from again. The fact of the matter is that we change physically in marriage. That is just part and part of the equation. We change financially, of course. Most of us, when we married, we had very, very little. We were poor, most of us, when we married, and then we had children, and we certainly then entered abject poverty. And then we tried to send them to college and ended up on the side of the road with a sign that said, "We'll work for tuition." I mean, we've kind of gone through those transitions. And then one day we kind of get to be like the man who tore down his barns and built bigger. We've all done that as well, haven't we? If you've been married for a while. And so we change financially, and then we change intellectually. Hopefully we continue to be lifelong learners, and we change spiritually, and hopefully we're changing spiritually for the better, growing closer to God so that we can grow closer in our marriage relationship. The issue is not whether or not we are going to change, but whether or not those changes in us will make us bitter or better. The winds of change. And then third, the flood of adversity. Marathon marriages survive the crises that they live through. And let me say, as you well know, that if you live long enough, it is inevitable that there are going to be crises of various kinds that will come into your marriage. They are inevitable. The flood of adversity flows into every marriage at some point in time because there are some things that you just can't control. It may be different in every marriage, but there are just things that you can't control. Being downsized on a job after 20 years of loyal employment, or the rebellion of a child, or the diagnosis that is bad, or the prognosis that is even worse, or a parent that you have that is debilitated in mind or body, or a financial loss that is just irreversible. And maybe you're in the deep water of some kind of a crisis right now. You need to know that God knows about that and God cares about that. Listen to what God said through Isaiah. "When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And through the rivers, they will not overflow you. And when you walk through the fire, you will not be burned, nor shall the flame scorch you. For I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel. I am your Savior." There are a couple of things about that verse, I think, for all the encouragement that it's designed to give, there are a couple of things in that passage that we don't care much for. The first is the path. Did you notice that? Sometimes you got to go through the water and through the river and through the fire. We don't really want to do that. We'd like to go around. We'd like to go over it. We'd like to be extricated out of it. But there are just some things in life that you've got to go through. And I don't think we like the speed of that very much. When you walk through the fire, nobody wants to walk through fire. I want to run through fire, zip through fire, fly through fire. Nobody wants to have to walk through fire. But there are some things in this life that you must go through, and you may have to go through them at a pace that would not be of your choosing. And so, the rain of culture and the wind of change and the flood of adversity. But in spite of that, if we will remember and honor our vows, we can have marathon marriages. I would imagine, audience of society, we have a lot of marathon marriages in this room tonight. Let me ask you tonight, is there anybody in this room who's been married for 60 years or more? Raise your hand if there is. Yes. How about that? That's wonderful. How many in this room have been married for 50 years or more? Raise your hand. Oh, there's several here who've been married for 50 years or more. How about 40 years or more? That would be me in my category. Yeah. It's interesting. A couple of years ago, for my 44th anniversary, I went into Starbucks in the morning. I go into Starbucks every morning. And I went in. I know all the kids who work in there. And I went in, and one of them behind the counter said, "Hey, Mr. Don, what are you doing today?" And I said, "Well, today's my anniversary, my wedding anniversary. So Vicki and I are going to spend the day together, and we're going to go get away for a few days." And this young lady behind the counter, she said, "Well, Mr. Don, how long have you been married?" And I said, "Well, I've been married 44 years. And she said, "44 years? And these were her words. She said, "I don't know anybody who's been married that long." And I told her, I said, "Look, I know lots and lots of people who've been married over 50 years. I know some people who've been married over 60 years. Isn't it sad that there's a generation of young people who can't even begin to wrap their minds around a marriage that would last that long?" So how do we do that? When I perform marriage ceremonies and we get to the vows, unless the couple wants to write their own, I still recite very traditional wedding vows. Now, sometimes couples want to write their own vows, and that's just fine, because even when couples write their own vows, they're really ending up saying what you say in the old traditional vows. They just say them in a different way, so that's certainly fine. But I like the old traditional vows because then when you go to a wedding through your married life and you go to a wedding, you're basically going to hear again what you promised your mate, and I like that. So I wonder if we could take just a few minutes tonight, in the minutes we have left, and let's just think about for a moment what we vowed and promised each other when we stood before God and men and we exchanged our vows with each other. For me, I said, I, Don Truex, take you, Vicki King. I take you. I think perhaps for all the things that we say in our wedding ceremonies and in our vows, that may be the most challenging thing that we say. I take you. As we said the other night when we spoke a little bit about marriage, that what we are saying in that is, I take you as you are. I understand that marriage is not going to be a vehicle for me to try to transform you, change you into some image that I have. I am taking you as you are. I realize there is so much about you that will be a blessing to me, but there may also be things about you that I may not particularly like, and yet I am taking you as you are. That's so very important. Mates who love each other, of course, will try to identify those areas where they know they have a trait that their mate doesn't like and try to do something about that. Several years ago, Michelle Warner Davis wrote a wonderful book entitled Divorce Busting. It was a great book with a bad title because it made it sound like it was for couples that were on the brink of divorce, and it really wasn't about that at all. But in one of her chapters, she talks about the fact that one of the most simple and best things that we can do in our marriages is just identify those things that we know are a problem for our mate in us and do something about that. Try to address that in some way. And so I take you as you are. I take you to be my lawfully wedded wife. I take you to be my lawfully wedded husband, perhaps you said to your husband-to-be. In that, of course, we were agreeing to a weaving process. I take you to be my wedded mate. We are agreeing to weave our lives together, that we are no longer an entity unto ourselves. It is no longer my money. It is our money. It's no longer my time. It is our time. It is no longer my future. It is our future. We are going to wed our life together. And while it is certainly true that every married couple must have some space, no doubt about that, the fact of the matter is that from this point on, our lives are wedded together. And we are saying in that I take you to be my lawfully wedded wife, which means much more than we are going to file some paperwork at a courthouse so that the great state of Texas will acknowledge that we are in fact a married couple. No. For Christians, this is saying that we are acknowledging that we are going to live by God's standard. That in this home and in this marriage, we are going to wed our lives together according to the principles that God has given. And we are acknowledging that. We are promising, vowing to each other that the rules of God apply equally to both of us. And we are not exempt. We are not a special case. The favorite story that I ever heard about Muhammad Ali when he was heavyweight champion of the world, it's a story about him flying somewhere, and the flight attendant came by and looked at him and said, Mr. Ali, you must put on your seatbelt. And Muhammad Ali looked at her and he said, little lady, Superman doesn't need a seatbelt. And she looked at him and said, Mr. Ali, Superman doesn't need an airplane. Put on your seatbelt. And it was just a kind way of saying that the rules are the same for everybody. And when we say, I take you to be my lawfully wedded wife, we are saying, look, we're going to weave our lives together according to God's law. Far too often when difficulties arise in a marriage, one or both of the parties decide that God's law, God's rule, God's way doesn't apply to them. But we have promised something different than that. To have and to hold. To have, I believe, is the only claim of a personal right in the wedding vows. It is an acknowledgement that when we marry, our body belongs to our mate. We talked about that the other night on Saturday night when we talked about maintaining sexual fidelity in our marriage, moral purity in our marriages. We talked about 1 Corinthians 7, beginning to verse 4 and 5, that familiar territory where Paul says, look, the mate has the power over your body. And we talked about the fact that there are two sexual sins in that passage. One sexual sin is giving your body to somebody to whom it does not belong, but the other sexual sin is withholding your body from the one to whom it does belong. But most importantly in that, ladies and gentlemen, we are vowing sexual fidelity. It would be impossible to calculate the damage that has been done to marriages by infidelity. Nothing will derail and destroy a marathon marriage any quicker than infidelity. So it means, as a married person, that we are certainly not to be making advances toward anybody who is not our mate, nor are we to be receptive to advances by anybody other than our mate. And we promise from this day forward. And that's really important, isn't it? From this day forward. Either an angel just got his wings or I'm out of time. Which is it? From this day forward. It's interesting that you do wedding ceremonies and the couples will walk to the back after you've pronounce them husband and wife, and they go to the back, and the preacher will stand in the front for a minute, usually make an announcement about about a reception or whatever, and then you walk to the back. It's interesting how many times a married couple, when you get back there, will say, are we really married? Isn't that amazing? I mean, they have planned for months for this day. They have spent the bride's father's life savings on this day, and they're wanting to know if they're really married. Well, yes, you really are. From this day forward, and I would especially say to the men in this audience, you need to remember this day, on this day forward, every year, so that it may be well with you and your life may be long on the earth. For better or for worse. And it is an acknowledgement that every marriage is going to have some four worse times. Times when you don't feel romantic, times when you pick at each other, times maybe when you blame each other, and 1,000 other challenges. Your attitude at that point in time will make or break the relationship for better or for worse. I was somewhere in a gospel meeting. I'd gone into a Hallmark store and I was looking for a card for Vicki I was going to send back to her. And I saw a card that on the front said, I love you more today than yesterday. And I thought, well, that's good, because I thought that surely on the inside it was going to be the rest of the lyric. I love you more today than yesterday, but not as much as tomorrow, which is the rest of the lyric. And so I picked up the card, and on the front, I love you more today than yesterday. But when I opened it, the inside said, because yesterday you really got on my nerves. I didn't buy that, by the way. There's a reason I've been married 46 years. I didn't buy that card. But the fact of the matter is that God doesn't call us always to be happy, ladies and gentlemen. We must come to understand that. He calls us to be faithful in our marriage, to keep what we promise to our mates. And we promise for richer or poorer. And it's certainly true that financial problems can put a strain on a marriage, but we ought to be honest, and financial prosperity sometimes can put a strain on a marriage as well. J. Oswald Sanders said that not every man can carry a full cup. We have all seen couples that in the early days of their marriage, the days of struggle financially, they did well, and they were close and loving. And then promotions came, and possessions came, and jobs came, and pressures came, and flirtations came, and idle time came, and moves came, and all of that sometimes combines to tax the endurance of the relationship. If God gives you prosperity, thank God for that. But vow and promise to each other that will not come between you and your mate in sickness and in health. Television rarely shows the reality of that, does it? It rarely shows a marriage where one of the partners is gravely ill, even ill with something like the flu, but certainly never gravely ill, having suffered a stroke or some other debilitating disease, and yet nobody who lives a full lifespan gets out of this world with perfect health and to love and to honor and to cherish. The point simply being that there are other kinds of love and affection beyond the sexual. There is simply love and honor, cherishing this individual. Especially to men, I would say that the only time that you are kind and tender and affectionate with your wife is when you have a sexual agenda in mind. She will feel used, and rightfully so. She is to be loved and honored and cherished simply for who she is and the relationship that you have, until by death we part. There's an old story, of course, that when Cortez came to the New World, that he burned his ships as a way of saying to his men, we're staying here. The biblical equivalent of that, of course, is when Jesus said, then shall a man leave his father and mother and shall be joined or cleave to his wife. Leave and then cleave. Our world has gotten that backward. It wants to cleave and then leave. But as we talked the other night, God's view is one man, one woman, one life, faithful and loyal to each other. Let me say to the young people in this audience that that's a challenging thought, isn't it? It behooves you to ask, as you were thinking about, as you date somebody and you're thinking about marriage, it behooves you to ask, do I know this person well enough to commit my life to them, all of my life to them, knowing that they are going to be the greatest single influence in my life as to whether or not I go to heaven. Let me give you something to take home tonight. I always try at the end to give two or three things to take home. Let me give you four things for all time. Here they are. Number one, your marriage can go stronger and better. Your marriage can grow stronger and better. The potential is there for that. But like all potential, it doesn't mean that it will happen. For some, after the wedding, there is a continual diminishing of love and devotion until finally individual says, well, you know, I just fell out of love with them. I don't love them anymore. Brother Sewell Hall, you know, he talks about that. He consistently says that when somebody says, well, I just don't love my wife anymore. I don't love my husband anymore. His response always is, well, when are you going to repent? Because the Bible says, husband, love your wives, and wives, love your husband. Your marriage can grow stronger and better, but it requires effort on our part. Secondly, communication is the lifeblood of any relationship, certainly a marriage relationship. As we've already seen, there'll be multiple stressors in every marriage, but the key is honesty and transparency in communication about those things. Third, remember that God heard and expects you to keep your vows. Remember, what did Malachi say? God has been a witness between you and the wife of your youth. That God was at your wedding ceremony, and he heard your vows. And now he watches your life to see whether or not you are keeping them. And fourth, the more you connect to Christ, the better you connect with each other. And so we end tonight where we began on Friday night, Psalm 127, the beginning of verse 1. Unless the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. I mean, let's be honest tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Everybody invites God to the wedding, but not everybody invites God to the marriage. And so we said the other night that the very best thing that you can do for your marriage, the best thing you can do as a mom or a dad or a grandparent for your children and grandchildren, is to strengthen your relationship with God. Because once you do that, you'll be devoted to your mate and to the children with whom God blesses your marriage, and to your grandchildren if you live long enough, so that you can be a blessing to them. Thank you for listening so wonderfully well. We began Friday night by just concluding saying, look, we all came to the family of God. We all want this family of God, and we all enter the family of God the same way. We were adopted by our Father. We were adopted by our Father when we bowed our hearts in obedience to him in the water of baptism. And he allowed us to have new life, to be born again. A newborn baby in the family of God. We all began exactly the same way. And if you would be a part of God's family tonight, there is no alternative to that. And so if you're in this building tonight and you understand that this is the night that you need to be obedient to God and begin your walk with him, and we can help you, we hope you'll let us. Let's stand and let's sing.